Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 224. The sound in the background is the weather. The other sound is the creaking of wagons as another great trek begins. We're going to trace the arc of Southern Africa's climate beginning in the early 19th century before turning to the decade under review, the 1860s, and following the path of the Griqua Great Trek into no man's land. First, let's get our heads around the cycles of drought and flood in Southern Africa, the pernicious climate. As Professor Mike Meadows of UCT's Environmental Sciences Department observed back in 2002, South Africa's climate has long danced to an unpredictable rhythm, one marked by dramatic shifts in both rainfall and its timing. Precipitation follows a kind of cycle, yes, but one that keeps its own secrets. Some years bring bounty, others drought. And the line between the two is often sharp and sudden. The climate, in short, plays favourites with no one. And when it comes to rain, it can be maddeningly capricious. So while the calendar may promise a rainy season, it rarely tells us how generous the skies will be. The patterns are there, but the quantities? That's anyone's guess. South Africa, after all, is a land of dryness. Over 90% of its surface falls under what scientists call affected drylands, a polite term for places where water is scarce and the margins are thin. The rest, even drier. Hyper-arid zones where the land holds its breath and waits. And by the mid-19th century, much of this land was beginning to fray under the strain, overgrazed, overworked, slowly giving way to the long creep of degradation. South Africa's landscape is anything but simple. It's rugged, sculpted by time with steep slopes and a dramatic stretch from the tropics to the temperate zone. But the story of our climate doesn't end on land. It's shaped by a swirling conversation between the oceans and the continents, a conversation held over centuries by systems with lyrical names. The Mozambique Channel Trough, the Mascarene High, the Southern Annular Mode, and the twin dipoles of the Indian and Atlantic Oceans. Then there's the heavyweight, the El Niño Southern Oscillation, or ENSO, which has long held sway over our rainfall and drought cycles. ENSO, El Niño's Southern Oscillation, in particular leaves fingerprints all over our climate records, going back as far as the 1700s, traced through what scientists call proxy data, tree rings, coral growth, old weather diaries. Most people know El Niño as the bringer of drought, and yes, that's often true, but not always. Every so often, El Niño arrives and breaks its own rules, bringing neutral or even wetter seasons instead. To remind ourselves, before diamonds drew fortune hunters and railway men to the interior, before the shimmer of Kimberley turned the land upside down, Southern Africa was largely an agricultural economy, supplemented as always by hunting and barter and the occasional war. But the 19th century was no peaceful pastoral idyll. It was a time of upheaval, politically, socially, and climatically. Across that long century, waves of settlers advanced, carving up land, displacing people. But nature, too, had its own campaigns. Droughts stalked the land. And for at least three decades, the rains were shy. Famines came and went, but one in particular carved its name in memory. In Sesotho, its name was Sekoboto in Zulu, Mahlathuli. It began around 1800 and tightened its grip by 1803. All crops failed. Cattle dropped where they stood. Across every class and clan, livelihoods vanished. The Cape Colony tried to stem the suffering, shipping in grain from Asia and Australia. But further inland, where state lines blurred and survival depended on the soil and the sky, people fought over what was left. Access to water and arable land became a matter of power. And those who had consolidated their influence, militarily and politically, often prevailed over those who hadn't. The famine even delayed the rhythm of life's great rites. Lepoko, the young man who would later rise as Moshoeshoe I, founder of the Basotho Nation, could not be initiated until 1804, when the land began to breathe again. Others, like the teenage Moletsane of the Batong, went ahead regardless. His initiation taking place in what is now the Free State near Steynsrus and Makwada. A reminder that even in shared hardship, communities respond differently, shaped by circumstance, courage, or the sheer necessity of time. And somewhere behind it all, although they didn't know the name Enzo, the El Niño Southern Oscillation was likely shifting its weight in the great global dance. El Niño, that mischief maker with a Spanish name and a planetary reach. He has a habit of showing up uninvited, upsetting the balance and then slipping away before anyone can hold the suspect accountable. So bear with me as I outline what weird cycles there were in this first 65 years of the 1800s, including up to that point 8 droughts. Between 1800 and 1807, the dry arrived, with some rain in 1803 and 1804, blamed on La Niña and El Niño. The same, 1811, 1812, dry again between the 3 years, 1816 to 1819. Then 1820, just in time for the 1820 English settlers. Then 1823, 1826, 1828, more drought. El Niño to blame there. Between 1835 and 1839, it was wetter than usual, with a dry year in 1838 caused by an El Niño. The Orange River flooded in 1840 and 41, a wet period there. But from the end of 41 to 43, yes, drought. 1849, there was a year of unheard of levels of snow, followed by 2 years of drought through 1852. 1854 was wet. Then between 1857 and 1863, there was a torrid drought. The Caledon River dried up, and water scarcity caused the Batlapeng people of Kuruman to migrate. There was some flooding in 1864, which then led to a malaria surge. So as you can see, between a couple of years of flood and a few of wet, it was pretty dry. What does all this tell us? It was long before machines and mines redrew the map. It was nature, unruly, capricious, sometimes cruel, that shaped the rhythm of life. In a land as diverse as its climates, where generations of people built their lives along riverbanks and wetlands, the seasons were both ally and adversary. But with industrialization on the horizon, a new kind of disruption was approaching, one that would unravel social bonds, not just with drought or flood, but with speed, steel, and the grinding momentum of progress. By the late 1820s, as the musket smoke of colonial wars began to settle over the Cape, something quieter but no less consequential was taking shape. The colony turned to technology in the face of thirst. The first dams of the Cape were built in 1828, small reservoirs of hope constructed not only for crops but for control. Agriculture even then was the chief consumer of water in the region and remains so to this day, particularly for large-scale commercial farms. But long before colonial engineers arrived with brick and blueprints, African communities had long known how to work with the land's rhythms. They'd built terraces to hold moisture on hillsides, turned slopes into sanctuaries, and conserved every drop with an intimacy born of necessity. Chiefs controlled the river water. These were not just techniques. They were traditions passed through hands and seasons, sustained by deep ecological knowledge. As the 1830s dawned, the Eastern Cape was already under duress. The wars of the Mfecane had scattered people and fractured polities. Crops had withered, and when drought struck in 1834, so severe that even the mighty confluence of the Orange and Vaal rivers dried to dust. It served as both a warning and a catalyst. All sorts of people, starting with the Khoikhoi, hemmed in and hungry, had been pushing into the interior from the Cape for over 150 years, and this process accelerated. They weren't just seeking space, they were chasing water. The movement intensified after 1836. Drought and famine, narrowly averted by leftover harvests and expanding settler populations, collided across the plains. Meanwhile, the Basutu were holding their ground. Their grain systems, like Matsema, allowed them to store and trade surpluses, often for livestock, giving them an edge. The drought of 1841 to 43 marked a turning point. It did not come alone. It brought with it the first clashes between the Basutu and settlers who were advancing from the Cape and the Free State. Conflict over land was now tangled with climate, and the people most exposed were those already exhausted from war and displacement. By then, the Basutu Nation was strong, numbering around 80,000. Their domain stretched between the Orange, Vaal, and Caledon rivers, encompassing fertile lands that had once offered refuge to those fleeing the chaos of the Mfecane. But fertile lands invite hungry eyes, and Mashweshwe, already a statesman and strategist, found himself managing not only political tensions but environmental ones. As settlers pushed northwards driven by dry spells and a search for land, the Basutu found themselves defending not only sovereignty but survival. Skirmishes became sieges, fields were burned, livelihoods collapsed, and famine set in. The War of 1858, as you've heard, was particularly brutal. After Mushweshwe refused to withdraw his chiefs from territory claimed by the Boers, the conflict escalated. The aftermath was grim. As snow fell for 3 days at the end of April, rare and cruel, many Basutu who had fled to the mountains were trapped. Their fields were ash, their granaries empty. This was also the beginning of a new slow migration. Young black men, especially from the Eastern Cape, began drifting towards towns. Labour was leaving the land, and it would not return in the same way. There was a brief reprieve. The rains of early summer in 1858 brought hope, and planting resumed. But it was false hope. Another drought struck mid-season. Year after year, from 1859 to 1863, the heavens remained tight-fisted. Agriculture failed. Rivers ran dry. Typhoid, the disease of thirst, crept in. In Lesotho, the crisis reached deep into cultural life. Chiefs asked priests to pray for rain, a tradition that endures even now. The Batlaping and Kuruman migrated in search of water. The Basutu, once grain-rich, now faced famine. Livestock died. Fields lay fallow. And Mushweshwe, once the leader of a strong and self-reliant nation, saw his people brought to the edge, not only by war, but by the long shadow of drought. Climatologists now believe the drought of 1861 to 1863 in southern Africa was the most severe of the entire 19th century. The vast repository of information about this, gentle listener, can be obtained from a discerning, if slightly mad, researcher by reading all the newspapers of the period. There's a long list, with one of the most important being the Natal Witness. The daily weather updates from 1846 onwards through the 19th century are a treasure trove of information about climate in Natal. By the late 1800s, the Natal Witness reporters covered much of the former Natal and Zululand, all collecting updates about the rain. Missionaries were another group who kept accurate records of rainfall, or the lack thereof. Zulu, Amaxosa, Tswana, Sotho, Venda, all the peoples of southern Africa have oral histories that back up these references. The power of human memory fitting neatly into the pattern of data collection. British officials who were scattered across the Cape and Natal and visiting the Free State and the Transvaal noted temperatures and rainfall. Daily journals are another source. However, there's another fact we know for sure. The 19th century was, on the whole, wetter than the 20th. And yet, even in those rainier decades, the signs of desiccation of a land slowly drying were already showing. Professor David Nash from Brighton University has a great load of data to back that up. It's in generous supply, freely available for anyone inclined to raise an eyebrow about what I've said. The dry was one of the motivations for another great trek about to take place. The Griquas, who had been living in the Transorangia since the late 1700s, began to question their position in the world. With the Boers controlling the Free State, and Mushweshwe controlling Lesotho, it was time to assess the options. In 1861, the Griqua joined the list of mass migrations of the 19th century in southern Africa. There had been the effect of the Mbatani, then the Voortrekkers, and now the Griqua. Some believe the Griqua trek was the most spectacular, although not of great size. 2,000 people left Philippolis to establish themselves in no man's land, far to the east, past Mushweshwe's land over the Drakensberg. The reason why historians like Cambridge's Robert Ross call it spectacular was the road that the Griqua cut for themselves across the high ridges of the mountains, a remarkable feat of engineering for the time. It was a caravan of more than 300 ox wagons and donkey carts that laboured across the veld to cross a place called Ongeluk's Neck, Accident's Neck. That gives you an idea of how dangerous this journey was. In a minute, I'll explain why it was called Ongeluk's Neck. Apart from the arid conditions they'd experienced, there were two other reasons for the Griqua to leave the Philippolis region. First, there was a place to go, although it had a somewhat menacing name, No Man's Land. Partly due to the clashes over this land stretching back for more than a century, and partly due to its heights, it was one of the last tracts of empty land remaining in South Africa. But as with all these things, empty land doesn't mean unclaimed. Chief Faku of the Amampondo claimed it, while Theophilus Shepston, who was native secretary of Natal, as you know, wanted to use it as a reserve for AmaZulu displaced by the civil war in Zululand. When Grey thwarted his plan, Grey also gave the Griqua permission to move there. That was 5 years earlier. The second reason, apart from the dry, was the change in culture around the Free State. The early Voortrekkers had referred to the Griqua as Menshen, the folk, the people. They had sat together, read their Bibles together, there were even cases of intermarriage. However, by the late 1850s and early 1860s, the new settlers, Dutch and English, were very different. They began referring to the Griqua as schepsels, creatures. The dehumanizing perception of the other had begun its insidious poison in the minds of these South Africans. The Griqua had developed some of the best sheep runs in the country, and the new arrivals were willing to pay good cash for their land. When the Friend newspaper published the Orange Free State's new laws in 1857, Adam Cook's jurisdiction over his land was challenged. The Free State Volksraad decreed there would be new veldkornetteries within Griqua land. The Free State decree went further. It stated that whenever any Griqua land shall be sold to anyone of European descent, such lands shall fall at once under the Orange River government. The Griqua were, as the record carefully notes, partly of European descent. But with this law, we catch the early scent of something darker, a bureaucratic itch to start sorting people by pigment. What exactly did of European descent mean? Half? Quarter? 6%? A great uncle who had once passed through Amsterdam? Suddenly, ancestry became a guessing game, played in courtrooms and council chambers, where skin tone was evidence and bloodlines were examined with all the rigour of a bad genealogy hobbyist. The state wasn't just legislating identity, it was squinting at it. Politically, the Griqua were in a bit of a pickle. When war broke out between Moshoeshoe and the Boers in 1858, Kok ordered his people to remain as neutral as possible. They were caught, as the saying goes, between a rocky mountain and a hard place. And so the whispers began, tales of a Griqua promised land shimmering at the edge of memory and myth. No man's land, they called it. And what a place it was. You've heard its name before. A wild territory riddled with trouble. Bandits rode out from its valleys to raid Natal, stirring unrest and giving Moshoeshoe no end of headaches. To the east, Chief Faku claimed it as his own, though the land paid little mind to claims. These Maluti Mountains had become a refuge, a last redoubt for Smith Palmer and his band of rebels who had fled the ruins of the Cat River Rebellion back in 1851. But peace was hard to come by. The Amabatla, who had long lived there, clashed bitterly with Palmer's followers. Stock theft turned daily life into a siege, and what was meant to be a sanctuary became a simmering frontier of feud and frustration. While the majority of Griqua left for No Man's Land in 1861, the first group to scout the area left a little earlier, 1859. A party of 100 men, wagons, horses and guns. They made their way from Philippolis, travelling southeast, through where Dordrecht is today, around the northern borders of the Transkei, through Maclear and Mount Fletcher, then down into the plains between the Imzimvubu and Imzimkulu rivers. After the parched dust of Philippolis, this land must have seemed like a dream. The men had just come through yet another of the many droughts we've spoken of, and now before them unfolded a landscape lush and green, rolling hills, rivers in full voice, breezes soft against the skin. It looked for a moment like salvation. But promised lands have a way of making promises they cannot keep. Most of the men decided this was their new home, and a small group made a snap visit to Chief Faku and the nearby small towns of Natal. They were convinced that they could grow coffee, sugar and rice on these rolling plains. It was just after winter when the small party set off back to Philippolis, directly over the mountains from the Kenega River, straight up the escarpment. It was at a neck in the crossing that a man shot himself by accident while unloading his wagon, and thus Ongeluk's Neck got its name. In 1860, a large group of Griqua men then met at Philippolis to make the momentous decision Should I stay or should I go? Some from the town called Rama wanted to stay. They'd been well treated by local Boer farmers, particularly after they'd fought alongside the Free Staters in the battles against Mashweshwe. Another group decided on the opposite route, to Namaqualand, where the Oorlam leader Jan Jonker Afrikaner wanted to welcome new Griqua into his control. By 1863, Griqua councillors were in fact installed there. Many others remained where they were, at Griqualand West. They'd lived there for 35 years, since the establishment of the captaincy of Philippolis, and weren't going anywhere. As with refugees and migrants across time and continents, it was mostly the poorer Griqua who felt the first stirrings to leave, the urgency, the necessity. But the wealthier among them soon followed. For all their differences, they shared one thing. They were Griqua first, not just individuals, not merely landowners. The Free State government's tightening grip made another thing clear: their way of life was under threat. The long-held dream of livestock on open land, vast farms stretching to the horizon, was slipping away. Each farmer held an erfposi of 3,000 hectares, a birthright they believed equal to that of the Boers. And like the Boers, their land was divided under Roman Dutch law, parcelled equally among children, legacy written into law. But now that legacy was fraying and the horizon no longer felt like home. For the established Griqua, the richer farmer, they sold their land, they thought, at exactly the right time. The wool boom was ongoing and land prices were high. Perhaps, they thought, new 3,000 hectare farms would be readily available in no man's land. What's striking is how little contact the Griquas made with African leaders before setting off. There was only the brief exchange with Chief Faku I mentioned, and a delayed word to Mashweshwe. Adam Kok spoke to him in 1862, after the first Griqua trek was already underway. This, despite the fact that thousands of Griquas were about to pass along the very fringes of Mashweshwe's territory, and more curiously still, they were heading toward land near Matatiel, where Mashweshwe's own son, Nehemiah, was trying to carve out a domain of his own. It was a journey shaped more by silence than by negotiation, and perhaps that silence would echo longer than anyone expected. What happened next is for next episode. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms. That helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog. I'm loading an update about various episodes there. You can email me from there too. Until next, tot ziens.